Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the May 9th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Before we get to today's program, on behalf of Joy LeClaire of Forthright Radio and myself, I want to thank all of you who contributed during our fundraising hour last month that exceeded the $2,100 goal the station has set for Takes on the World and Forthright Radio's efforts. Overall, however, while the fund drive brought in much-needed dollars from you listeners, all of which was appreciated, it fell short of our overall goal, and so for just this one time, until our next fundraiser, I'm going to depart from the script for a moment and just ask those of you who are regular listeners to Takes on the World or to Forthright Radio and have yet to make a pledge for KZYX during our joint fundraising appeals to become one with your conscience and call the station right now at 895-2324 and make your pledge or do it online at kzyx.org. Do it now, and I assure you it will make your day and ours so much brighter. Well, shortly after my last pre-fundraising program, I opened the pages of the April 25th Anderson Valley Advertiser to find a letter to editor Bruce Anderson from Fort Bragg resident Laurel Krause. She was writing about an important piece of new information she had obtained regarding the murder of four students and the wounding of nine others protesting President Nixon's expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia at Kent State in Ohio 42 years ago, this past May 4th. One of those killed by National Guard troops that day was Laurel's sister, Allison. Her letter was part of a general appeal to the mainstream and alternative media to reopen the Kent State case and, if possible, bring those responsible to justice or, at the very least, determine who gave the orders for the only incident in which American anti-war protesters were deliberately shot and killed. I phoned Laurel to find out if there had been any response from national media and learned that not only had there been no response, but that the Obama administration's Justice Department had decided just 3 days earlier not to reopen the case despite solid evidence that the Ohio Guardsmen had been ordered to fire at the students by their commander, and you will get a chance to hear that evidence when at 20 minutes past the hour I get Laurel on the phone. I woke up early Monday to hear, as many of you did, the reports on BBC and NPR of the latest thwarting of an Al-Qaeda-sponsored terrorist attack by air by our ever-alert CIA. Yesterday afternoon, it was revealed that the would-be suicide bomber, allegedly dispatched by the Yemen branch of Al-Qaeda last month to blow up a United States-bound airliner, was actually an intelligence agent for Saudi Arabia who infiltrated the terrorist group and volunteered for the mission. According to the New York Times, he, quote, delivered both the innovative bomb designed for his aviation attack and inside information on the group's leaders, locations, methods, and plans to the CIA, Saudi intelligence, and allied foreign intelligence agencies. How convenient for Washington and how strange it is that almost all the events connected with Al-Qaeda and even going back to the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, we find a U.S. or friendly government agent in the very center of things, whether volunteering to carry out an attack of terrorism or, as in the World Trade Center of 1993, providing the materials and know-how to carry it out. In this connection, here's a short revealing clip of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking some time ago in Washington, which was in my email box yesterday that I thought I should share with you.
History of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan. And we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what? Sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military. And let's go recruit these Mujahideen. And let's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union. And guess what? They retreated, they lost billions of dollars, and it led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's a very strong argument, which is wasn't a bad investment to end the Soviet Union, but let's be careful what we sow because we will harvest. So we then left Pakistan. We said, okay, fine, you deal with the stingers that we've left all over your country. You deal with the mines that are along the border. And by the way, we don't want to have anything to do with you. In fact, we're sanctioning you. So we stopped dealing with the Pakistani military and with ISI, and we now are making up for a lot of lost time.
Certainly is, Hillary Clinton and the White House. Hillary Clinton speaking, I'm not sure the date, but it was some time ago, testifying in Washington. Secretary of State Clinton seems to be on a never-ending trip lecturing countries around the world about what they should or shouldn't be doing. She found herself questioned about Israel's nuclear weapons when in Delhi she was pressuring India to reduce its massive oil purchases from Iran. Following in the craven footsteps of her predecessors, as well as every White House occupant since JFK, Madam Secretary did not acknowledge that Israel even had nukes. According to the Hindu Times, responding to a question on the U.S. pressing for sanctions on Iran on account of its nuclear program, while taking no action against Israel and its, which is in violation of several United States resolutions, apart from not being a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Mrs. Clinton quipped, "Well, I don't think we have convinced India to sign the NPT either." She then went on to repeat the canard that Iran has threatened to wipe Israel off the map and emphasize what again is provided without proof that Iran is a worldwide terrorist threat. In Israel's position, Clinton said, with, quote, "leaders of a country saying that they want to wipe you off a map, they want to destroy you, they want to end the presence of the Jewish people," end quote, "it would be worrying," end quote, excuse me. She's right. It would be worrying if it were true, but it isn't. Iran has the largest population of Jews outside of Israel in the Middle East, and they are well protected. In any case, while it's acknowledged that diplomats are sent abroad to lie for their country, it should be considered unusual when Clinton, like her predecessors, spreads lies for a country not her own. But as those before her, it has come to be expected. For the record, as I mentioned in a previous program, neither the Israelis nor their supporters have provided any evidence that any Iranian leader has made such statements, and former Foreign Minister Dan Meridor, who I quoted recently, admitted it. And speaking of Israel, the world's media seems to spend time virtually every day speculating on whether or not nuclear-armed Israel, is going to attack Iran over its alleged but unproven nuclear weapons program. Until the past few days, and for some weeks, much of the focus has been on statements by current and former high-ranking Israeli generals and intelligence officials who have questioned not only the wisdom and potentially catastrophic consequences of such an Israeli attack, but the sanity of both Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Ehud Barak. Those sentiments apparently are not shared by the majority of Israelis, for whom Netanyahu remains immensely popular, a fact that he no doubt had in mind when he declared last week he was scheduling new national elections for September 4th. The reaction of most observers, both inside and outside of Israel, to this news was that should Netanyahu achieve an overwhelming victory in the September polls, as anticipated, which would be well before the U.S. elections, he would take this as a mandate and be in a position to take action against Iran without worrying about Washington's objections. Then this week, we learned that the elections are off, and the Netanyahu's Likud party had entered into a coalition with the country's next largest party, Kadima, which was founded by the still comatose former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, and while described in the U.S. media as quote-unquote center-right, Kadima is, like its new partner, Likud, as far, if not further to the right, than any major political party in Europe. Commentator Nahum Barnea in Israel's largest-selling newspaper, Yediot Ahronot, was not pleased. Quote, "What's happening here was a convergence of interest between two politicians, each one with his own trouble," wrote Barnea. "Mr. Mofaz has an abundance of Knesset members, but no voters. Mr. Netanyahu has an abundance of voters, but he saw his party and his coalition gradually slipping away from his hands. The damage to Israeli democracy is that from now, the government has no parliamentary opposition," end quote. So writes Nahum Barnea and Yediot Ahronot on the state of Israeli domestic politics in the second decade of the 21st century. There is something about Chinese dissidents that the American media and some politicians find irresistible. As every few months, one of them and their ill treatment at the hands of the Chinese government briefly dominates the headlines. The latest, of course, is the blind lawyer Chen Guangcheng, whose flight from house arrest in Shandong to the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, his subsequent transfer to a hospital and the custody of Chinese authorities, followed by his plea for asylum in the U.S. as a traveling companion for Secretary of State Clinton, has largely overshadowed the week's annual strategic and economic dialogue in Beijing. While China is America's now and future competitor, on this trip, capitalism, both the Chinese communist variety and the traditional Wall Street product, triumphed for the moment over the competitive aspect of the relationship. Clinton, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, and other U.S. officials who were in Beijing reportedly got the Chinese government's agreement to further open the country's financial markets, allowing foreign companies to control 49% of domestic security firms, while giving Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and others a bigger cut from the world's second-largest share market. They haven't received and won't get the same degree of attention from the U.S. media and Congress as Chen Guangcheng, but two Palestinian prisoners have now passed their 70th day as part of a mass hunger strike in Israel, and they're reportedly near death, their conditions deteriorating from, quote, bad to extremely worse, according to their lawyer, while eight others have also been hospitalized, two of them also reported critically in critical condition. Lawyer said, I believe what the court is doing here is trying to break the will of both prisoners so they will back down on their hunger strike, Jamil Al-Khatib told CNN Sunday of Bilal Diab, 27, and Tahir Halala, 33. Diab was moved to a civilian hospital last week while Halala was taken to a prison medical facility. While 1,500 to 2,500 Palestinian prisoners have been on a wide-scale hunger strike since the 17th of April, demanding better conditions and an end to detention without trial. The conditions of Diab and Halala have drawn the most attention in the Arab world, but have failed to make a dent in the Israeli-occupied Washington. An estimated quarter to half of all Palestinians held in Israeli jails are participating in the hunger strike. They have been detained for alleged offenses that range from throwing stones to killing civilians in brutal attacks, but many have been not charged at all, but have simply been arrested and held under a system called, quote, administrative detention, which was introduced by the British against Jews during the Mandate, and since Israel has no constitution, has opportunistically been maintained by successive Israeli governments since the founding of the state. Most of those refusing food 19 days ago, but a smaller core has been striking longer. Among the prisoners' chief demands are a halt to administrative detention, which is usually for six-month periods but can be extended by low-rank officers almost indefinitely. Prisoners are also demanding an end to solitary confinement and the restatement of family visits from Gaza. Leading members of Hamas have reportedly issued a warning to the Israeli government that if any of the prisoners die while on hunger strike, they will retaliate. On April 29th, a headline in the New York Times read, Walmart's U.S. expansion plans complicated by bribery scandal, end quote. In Los Angeles, a Walmart building permit is getting a once-over, the story read. In New York, the city council is investigating a possible land deal with a retailer's development in Brooklyn. A state senator in California is pushing for a formal audit of a proposed Walmart in San Diego. And in Boston and its suburbs, residents are pressuring politicians to disclose whether they have received contributions from the company. And all of it in the past week, noted the article. The bribery scandal that the Times is referring to was one that broke the previous week, which indicated that Walmart officials, back in 2005, had spread around $24 million in bribes to Mexican government officials in order to assure favorable decisions and treatment by local and state officials wherever they wanted to open, and in Mexico, they now seem to be open everywhere. Such payoffs, however, are illegal under U.S. law, and what clearly appears to have been an attempt by Walmart officials at the highest level who were informed of the payoffs to cover them up has drawn the attention of the Justice Department. All of this was no doubt in the back of the minds of the Walmart officials in Bentonville, Arkansas, when they made the decision not to even make a pro forma appeal to the Ukiah City Council of the Planning Commission's decision to reject its plans to add another 59,000 square feet to the current Walmart store and transform it into a 24/7 full-service grocery and liquor store. It should be quoted or noted, as since the New York Times article that I cited was written, all of New York's five pension funds, which control nearly 5 million Walmart shares, have announced that they will attempt to unseat members of the company's board of directors at the Walmart's annual meeting on June 1st. This news was followed by a report from the California State Teachers Retirement System, or CalSTRS, of which I am a minor member. It has filed suit against the Walmart directors and executives responsible for overseeing the company's Mexican unit, demanding that it reimburse the giant retailer for damages the chain suffered as a result of the bribery scheme. Quote, the board's prolonged failure to address detailed and credible allegations of criminal activity, end quote, has caused the retailer, quote, substantial harm, the pension fund said in the complaint. Walmart stock immediately dropped 17.6% after the New York Times revelations, and just yesterday Fortune magazine reported that ExxonMobil has bumped Walmart from first place among the Fortune 500 top revenue-generating U.S. companies. From what it seems, Walmart's annual meeting on the 1st of June is likely to produce some more bumping and, it is nice to envision, some unprecedented head rolling.